You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Now I'm joined on the phone with Green Party co-leader Materia Ture. How are you going, Materia?
I'm doing good, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. So first up, let's talk about superannuation. The Prime Minister is currently facing heat over his hints that there might be some changes to the scheme. Do you think it's likely that it will go up?
That the age will go up? They might be suggesting it. It's been part of the conversation for a long time. It's very difficult given that there's been a consensus about superannuation, a hard-fought-for consensus, political consensus about it. There has been, though, real issues around is it affordable, how are we going to manage it with an ageing population and all of that. And it's very difficult to have a sensible conversation without it getting out of control. So I think Bill has been foolish in hinting about it and not saying anything, and all he's doing is giving other political parties giving political parties a sort of a platform to stand on, and two, making those people, particularly older people who are living in poverty, and there is a real portion of them now, making them feel really insecure about what's going to happen next. So I think he's done the wrong thing. If he's going to change it, he should just say so, because it's such a hot issue and so concerning for so many people.
And so what's the Green Party's take on the super age? Should it stay the same?
We would enter into a conversation about it if there was a nationwide conversation that was sensible and careful. But we've committed to the consensus of 65. For me, it's not actually a question about whether we can afford to pay super for this particular cohort as they go through. The question is, what kind of income support do we think that New Zealanders should have, and then how do we structure our system to make sure we can provide it? The glaring issue here is that we have lots of different kinds of income support. At the superannuation end, it comes with no strings at all. It's just a straight entitlement. The welfare system is full of criteria that excludes people and drives people into really severe poverty, particularly people who have families, people with disabilities. And then in the early stages of life, you have families who get a very sporadic support for when they have small children. We don't have a universal child payment. We have a very complicated working for family system. So we have an irrational income support set of policies for New Zealanders that's not based on a sort of a rational sense. A series of principles about the extent to which people need income support versus the income they get from work, and that makes everything very complicated.
Wait, so you see superannuation as not working in a functional way then, if you compare it to other sorts of income support measures?
Yeah, it's highly functional because it's universal and it's without condition. So from the point of view of reducing poverty for older people, it has been one of the most effective tools that New Zealand has ever used for reducing poverty. And it's well known to have kept our poverty rates for older New Zealanders at a very low rate internationally. So, as an income support tool, it's incredibly effective, but that's because it's universal. By having this conversation about superannuation, which is important, but it means that we're not then talking about, well, what other kinds of support are needed by other families in New Zealand who are actually suffering much higher rates of poverty and income insecurity, and how do we best support them? So I think to that extent, superannuation wouldn't be my first priority for thinking about income support. Actually, we've got one of the highest rates of child poverty, and it continues to stagnate at a very high rate. Over 200,000 children live in poverty, many of them, nearly half of them, in severe hardship, and there's just no rational conversation that's happening about how to make sure them and their families are doing all right. The other thing I would say, though, is that those on superannuation just starting to really suffer from housing insecurity. So there are increasing numbers of people who are entering, who are getting to 65, who do not own their own home. So they are very much like the younger cohort. they're renting, their rents are expensive, their housing is really insecure, and on a fixed income like superannuation, if they don't have any other income to supplement it, they find it very difficult to maintain decent quality housing. So the housing crisis is also starting to have a huge effect on this more recent cohort of people entering 65 and relying on superannuation. So this is what I mean. The political talk about changing the age from 65 to 67 is a complete distraction from what is actually happening to both newer group of older people and their housing insecurity and their income insecurity, and ignoring all of those other New Zealand families who are also suffering from poverty.
Right, so because superannuation is kind of this universal thing, as you say, that it's like this blanket thing for all people over that age, when you're saying that the conversation should more be around people who are struggling. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Well, I think so. And I mean, if for example, there's a big concern about the stability poverty rates for older people, then we really need to be looking at housing. That there's a huge demand for secure, stable and safe pensioner housing, for example. Housing that is safe for pensioners tends to be safe for families with young children as well, if it's built right. So, you know, I think it is important that we have this conversation about super, because there is a big cost coming down the line and we do need to prepare for it, and that's a very real one. We also have the current poverty that's suffered today. That poverty leads to, for example, 15 children on average dying every year as a result of sickness driven by poor quality housing. So, you know, we have an immediate and urgent problem right now for a large portion of our New Zealand families. We have this other issue that's coming down the track for another portion of New Zealand families. We do have to do both, but often in politics, it's the easier question and the question that concerns people who actually vote them.
I think that's
problematic.
And so in terms of focusing on the cost of superannuation, though, it is forecast to rise pretty hugely, so more than $20 billion a year by 2031, up from $11 billion this year. So how would the Green Party propose paying for that?
Well, that's right. This is why we need to have the national conversation. It's like, are we going to continue with exactly the same system that we have at the moment, where there's a universal payment at that end, at the older end, and not for others? Are there other ways of structuring our economy and the way it works? We certainly need to be making contributions to the super fund, which National stopped, but which is a critically important fund for stabilising the cost to future generations of future super. This is not a simple issue. We can't just say that there's going to be some extra special way of funding it. We have to be looking at it seriously and looking at what kind of universal support we should be providing across the whole life cycle of families, including superannuation. And that might also include reducing the obligations burden on people who are in their 50s. And who are relying on the benefit, reducing the obligations burden for those who are on disabilities, for example. I mean, it's not, you can't deal with it in isolation.
Mm, right. And so moving on, let's talk about changes to the Resource Management Act. Can you talk me through what these changes are exactly?
Yeah, so many of the ones that concern us are changes to give Nick Smith as the minister. Oh God, Nick. The ability to basically override plans. So he'll be able to override district and regional planning documents that have already gone through often many years of consultation with their local communities to determine the rules. If, for example, there was a big housing development or other kind of industrial development somewhere that the rules did not provide for or allow to happen, the minister could override that rule and essentially give approval to it. If the council wanted to notify a section of the community about a big development that was happening, the minister would be able to override that. They're also making changes so that councils have fewer obligations to notify people about what's happening. If a community wanted to make decisions about land use as part of the rule setting in district plans and regional plans. Like, for example, not allowing for the release into the environment of GMOs. The minister could override that rule, even if it was properly consulted and determined using the proper council processes under the RMA. So fresh water, there are powers that the minister would have to override community decisions about protecting and trying to clean up fresh water bodies like rivers and aquifers and lakes. So there's a huge amount in this RMA that gives the minister the power over the communities and over the councils. I mean, and that's just deeply undemocratic. The RMA was built to give communities the ability to have a say and to have a bit of a balance between between different communities, actually, who have different views. But it certainly was never designed to give the minister the power to completely override councils and communities on their decisions.
Right, okay. So the main sort of issue that the Green Party has with this is basically that it gives the minister too much power.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just anti-democratic. Basically, the RMA has been changed so that the minister gets to make all the decisions and the councils can still go through long processes and expensive ones of consulting their community. But communities have no certainty that that consultation will mean anything. The minister can simply, you know, get a few mates in who are developers and they want a certain kind of development to go ahead and the council rules don't allow it. Well, the minister gets to decide whether it goes ahead or not. I mean, these are not small changes. This is a radical reform of the RMA, which was designed to give communities the right to make decisions.
And so,
National was taking that.
And so, what are you advocating instead? That it stays the same, or that sort of incremental changes happen?
Well, I mean, it's always good to be looking at the RMA and tightening up the rules. But the fundamental premise that firstly, that it's designed to protect the environment. And its resources and its services to communities for the long term, and two, that it protects local democracy. I mean, those are two fundamentals that were negotiated hard, like in very hard times, when the RMA was first designed and written. And those two things need to stay at the core of it. But this rewrite is a radical reform of that and removes those two fundamental principles of it. So the RMA, you know, as it was designed and hard fought for, has been very significantly eroded with these reforms.
But the minister is arguing, though, that the reform will improve efficiency and speed up the release of greenfield and brownfield land in urban areas. Isn't this a necessary step in addressing the housing crisis and providing affordable housing quickly?
No, well, as Auckland has already agreed to, you know, again, with a long and hard fight, that the best option is up, not out, that there is actually a huge opportunity already with the engineering plan for there to be significant development in the sort of more regional parts of Auckland City. That's already been loosened. We don't need to do any more. There's lots of opportunity for the protection of transport and other infrastructure corridors that the council can use. Should there be development further out in the regional areas around Auckland, that's already possible. And most people in Auckland City are saying that they want to be able to live close to town, close to shops, close to schools and close to public transport. None of that is possible if you have mass urban sprawl. And we were seeing some of the developments in Auckland City further out on the outskirts. There's been the housing developments have happened, some good quality, some not, but the promised public transport never turned up. So people have been moved out there on the understanding that not only was there housing, but there was public transport to be able to get them to and from, you know, work and school. And that's just not there. So now they're stuck with homes where they are car dependent. And, you know, there's a huge amount of expense in both time and money that goes into the constant private car transport when you're living out in those areas. So if Auckland wants a decent city that actually works for the people who live in it, sprawl is not the answer, and certainly not giving Nick Smith the right to make decisions over what happens in your city.
But so you're saying that the RMA will kind of prompt more of a urban sprawl rather than sort of housing density?
Yes, because in large part because the rules, you know, Nick Smith wants to reserve to himself the power to override council rules. And that's what these reforms do. So despite all of that work that went on with the plan and, you know, just, you know, that huge kind of trauma of kind of understanding the growth needs of Auckland and, you know, all those communities that made it such a huge effort to participate, if this these reforms go through, Nick Smith will be the one that decides what Auckland City looks like. And that, I mean, I don't think anybody could possibly want that.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us this week, Matidia. We'll talk to you again in 2 weeks.
All good.
Cool. Have a great afternoon.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.